This is Digital Story Podcast number 723, January 28th, 2020. Today's theme is Pro Gear worth the premium price? I'm Derek Story. Camera manufacturers build Pro Gear for a handful of professionals who need its durability for their work and for bragging rights that create a halo effect for aspiring shooters who want the very best. But for weekend warriors and enthusiasts, is the premium price tag a wise investment? We'll explore this question and help you get to the bottom of it on today's TDS Photography Podcast. Over the years, I've made a lot of clients happy with cameras such as the Canon 5D Mark II, Nikon D610, Olympus OMD EM5 Mark II, and the Pentax KP. No one ever asked me why I wasn't shooting with a Nikon D5 or Canon EOS 1DX Mark II, but the investment difference was substantial for me, and that's to say the least. And you can have similar considerations apply to lenses as well. One of my favorite examples is the Canon EF 70-200mm zoom. You can buy the amazing F4L IS version 2 for $1,299. It is one of the sharpest 70-200s on the planet. Or you could spend $2,100 when it's not on sale for the 70-200 F28L IS version 3. That extra f-stop will cost you $800. So as you start thinking about this, you know, you start going, okay, how do I really make sure that I have both the best gear that I need, right, that I need for my photography, and at the same time, am managing my budget well? And, you know, one of the reasons why this is worth thinking about, I'm not just being, you know, Mr. Frugal here. Really, I'm not. And here's why. Because, for instance, let's go back to that 70-200mm lens that we just saved $800 on by getting the F4 instead of the F2.8. Now I have that $800 to either keep in the bank account or not add to my credit card debt or use for something else, such as another camera body, such as another lens. So by managing, you know, our equipment investment, in other words, by making sure we're buying the right gear for absolutely the best price possible, then you could also look at it, if you chose to, as a way to get more gear. Now, I don't want to be a guy that promotes gas here, okay, but I'm just saying this is the reality of the situation. So to help you with all of this, and, you know, this is not something that most of us haven't thought about, right? I mean, we're all sort of thinking, okay, you know, how can I get this or how can I pay for that? All that kind of stuff. But sometimes we don't get analytical about it. And that's what I want to do here. I want to get a little analytical about it. Okay, so here we go. Guess what? I have this broken into 5 questions. And I know that alone is a shock right there, right? That's, you're going, 5? How did you come up with 5? I don't know. It just worked out that way. Okay, here we go. Let's start with the first one. How much is emotion driving the decision? Okay, I think this is a biggie in photography, and that's why I'm starting out with it. Because, first of all, people who make and sell camera gear understand this about us. They understand that emotion is a big component with what we're doing. And of course it is. And we don't want to strip emotion out of our photography because that's part of what makes our pictures wonderful, right? We have emotion. We're trying to elicit emotion. We feel this fondness for our gear, right? I mean, there's a lot of emotion mixed up in here, and we want to hang on to that. However, we don't want to have that used against us by marketing people who sometimes, you know, say, hey, we can leverage that emotion and sell them something for $4,000. So I think it's fair to ask the question, you know, when you're thinking about something, all right, how much of this is, you know, analytical? How much of this is a lens that I truly need to do this? And how much of this is that, you know, these guys just got under my skin and I want it. And I want it bad. One of the ways that I think we can work through that is allow time to come into the equation. And I do this and with varying results, actually. Or, well, maybe the results are always right. I'm not sure. But let me explain. So, for instance, I will see something. Something will be announced. And I go, oh, my gosh, I want that. I have to have it. I have to have it. Please, 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 please. Thank you for answering my prayers. But I don't buy it right away, no matter how badly I want it. What I do is I live with it for a couple days. I do. I live with the thought of it for a couple days. Now, I can sort of satisfy my desire, especially if it's just announced, but it's not shipping yet. Then you can put your, you know, name on the list to be notified. You can, you know, take steps like that without actually giving your credit card number and feel like, okay, now I'm in the hunt, right? I'm in the queue. I'm lined up so that I am the 45th person that will be notified when this camera is ready for sale. So you can do that sort of stuff. I'm talking about actually, you know, writing the check or giving them your credit card number. Wait a couple days. Wait a couple days. Let the emotion kind of balance out with the rest of you. It's very exciting when we see something that, you know, we just fall in love with. Are we still in love 2 or 3 days later? Now, I said that I've experienced this with varying results because many times, maybe close to half the time, I'm just as much in love 2 to 3 days later as I was when I first saw it, right? In other words, now I can't stop thinking about it. Now I'm thinking about when I go to sleep at night. I'm thinking about when I wake up in the morning. I'm thinking about it during lunch break the next day. All right, if that goes on for a couple days, then I think you're pretty well hooked. And yes, you have emotion, but I think now you have to move on to the next point, which is how do I figure out how to get this? Okay. So if you pass the 2 to 3 day emotion test and you're still crazy nuts about it, now you got to start figuring out how to make it happen. But anyway, give it the emotional litmus test before you just right away pay for it. Okay, second one, do your research. And research is the anecdote sometimes to emotional decisions or the way that we can make them happen, depending on, you know, where you came out at after 2 to 3 days of living with this thing that you have to have. Here's an example of kind of working through that process. Let's say that the Olympus 45 millimeter f1.2 pro lens was just announced. Now, obviously, it was announced a while back, but this is one that got me, okay? So I'm using it as an example. So the 45 millimeter f1.2 pro lens, you know, comes out and let's say it's $1,100 when it comes out. It's a very nice lens, right? It's weather sealed. It's really fast. It looks good. It has this wonderful optical formula. And I'm going, but I have already the 45 millimeter f1.8, which is available right now for $299. And that lens is very compact. It's really sharp. It's fast. It's f1.8. It's not exactly, you know, chopped liver here. And as I mentioned, it's affordable. Either I'm weighing between these two or I already have, you know, the cheaper one. And I'm thinking about the 45 millimeter. Well, this is when research comes in really handy, in addition to overlaying it with your actual needs. And one of the things that I discovered with these two lenses is that the 45 millimeter f1.8 really does hold its own in terms of sharpness against the f1.2. Where the f1.2 truly excels is that it's brighter, of course, f1.2, super bright. It's weather sealed, okay? And you might get a little different shape in terms of the sharpness. In other words, the f1.8 is going to be sharp in the center, maybe close to as sharp in the center as the f1.2, but it's going to tail off a bit more, whereas the f1.2 is going to have better, you know, edge-to-edge sharpness. Now, you're thinking about how do I shoot? If I'm using it mainly for portraits, then that tailing off on the edges is not really a big deal. In fact, it's kind of something that maybe you even like a little bit for the type of shooting that you do. And you're not out in inclement conditions much with it, or you don't have a camera that's weather resistant. You're not putting it on an EM1 Mark II. Let's say you're putting it on a Pen-F, which isn't weather sealed. If your camera isn't weather sealed, it doesn't really do much good to have a lens that's weather sealed. So you do your research, you get the stats, you make a pros and cons chart here. You really understand the optical performance of the lens, and then you sit there and look at it. And that will help you with your decision. Now, if you come out at the end of it, just like with the emotional thing, that, you know what, this is really a good lens for me. And I'm talking about the expensive one now, the F1.2. Then at least you can articulate the reasons why. And this is really helpful when someone asks you, well, why are you spending $1,100 on that lens? And then you can go bam, bam, bam. Not only does that help you articulate your case to someone else, that also helps you articulate the case to you. And that helps eliminate buyer's remorse after you spent $1,100 on this lens. So do your research, get your numbers down, really understand what the item is all about, not only for you explaining to other people, but for you explaining it to yourself. Third thing in this consideration game, renting specialized gear instead of buying. You know, one of the questions you have to ask yourself, are you a generalist photographer, or do you need special gear for niche assignments? Let's say super macro photography would be one of those things. Because if you're more of a generalist photographer, you can get good gear for fairly affordable prices. And we're talking about, for example, the 45mm f1.8, right? $299 for that lens. That's a good price, okay? That's a really good price. So maybe the approach would be, if you're only doing niche photography sometimes, is for those sometimes rent instead of buy. You don't have to own everything, okay? Now, renting isn't super cheap in itself. And anyone who's rented gear knows, hey, that kind of added up on me there. And if I'm going to be renting this all the time, maybe I should think about buying it. But if it's only occasional and you're trying to manage your budget month to month, then renting is an option to help keep you out of the poorhouse, all right? To help keep your credit card debt from exploding on you. So it's something to think about, especially for those exotic items. You're going to do some bird photography. You don't have to go out and buy the Olympus 300mm f4 lens. If it's just like kind of a one-off thing and you're really lucky to get to go do this, this event, then maybe you want to rent it. See what you think about it and then decide afterwards. Factor that in with your research. So renting specialized gear instead of buying is something that can be helpful when you're working through this equation. The next thing to do when you're thinking about, okay, I'm actually going to buy this thing, or I want to buy something that meets this need, consider the resale value. Factor that in. And, there's some interesting thinking that goes on here. I did exceptionally well when I sold my Canon DSLR gear. I really felt like, I recovered a lot of the money that I had initially spent. And I had kept the original boxes, which I think is very important. I had kept most of the original paperwork. I had all the stuff, and I take care of my gear. So I got nice money back, from that investment that I could use to invest in other things. I wanted to invest in more Olympus gear. I want to invest in some more Pentax gear. I want to invest in some more Nikon gear. So, that money really helped me do that. As you're looking at buying something new, try to look into your crystal ball and see the direction that the market is going. If the market is going in the direction of something that you're interested in, then your odds of being able to resell it if you need to up the road are going to be better. And, right now, I would think that Canon mirrorless gear, Olympus mirrorless gear, those kinds of things, Sony, obviously, mirrorless gear, even Nikon to some degree, that should sell well up the road because, all those companies are going to keep doing what they're doing. Whereas a really expensive DSLR lens right now, maybe not quite the resale value that it once had. I'm not downplaying or saying that it's not useful or you shouldn't buy it. I'm just saying that if you're thinking of recouping some of the money after you've used it for a while, that might be harder than with, let's say, a Sony telephoto lens that probably you'd be able to sell 3-4 years up the road, no problem. So think about the resale value, because in the end, if you spend $1,000 for a lens, you sell it for $700 and you use it for 3 years, you really only paid $300 for that lens. And, you know, that's a pretty good deal. And then finally, the fifth thing to consider when you're thinking about these sort of things is used versus new. And my favorite used versus new story has to do with the Panasonic Lumix G20mm f1.72 a spherical lens. I came up in a situation after I got the Pen F where I really needed that lens for what I was going to do. It checked all the boxes for me. But at a time when I really didn't have the budget, I couldn't justify the budget to buy a new one. So I'm going round and round about this. And then finally I decided I would investigate the used market for this lens. I did. I found a really good price on one that was exactly what I wanted. It was in good shape and I was able to buy it. It fit within my budget. Moving it from new to used allowed me to purchase it when I wanted to purchase. And I've been using that lens ever since, and it's performed wonderfully. So that is another way sometimes, if you're trying to be responsible about your gear acquisitions, looking at the used market sometimes will bring it down enough to where you can get it in the budget and still have what you need. Now, using these five steps that I just discussed, and I'll recap them for you, really looking at the emotion and how much is driving your decision and how to deal with that, doing your research in all areas of this, not only how you're going to use it and what its features are, but also, you know, its performance, renting specialized gear instead of buying sometimes, considering the resale value and doing used versus new. By using these five things, I have been able to meet all of my assignment needs for the last 10 years while maintaining a tight budget that I could justify to anyone. And we all know the people we have to justify our budget to, including ourselves, right? Because we want to feel like we're being responsible artists, photographers, business people. It feels good to do business this way. It feels good to do art this way. Take a look at these things. I have them all listed for you in the show notes. Apply it to something right now that you're jonesing for. And I would love to hear how it works out. I'll have this podcast posted on our Facebook page. You can go over there and comment if you wish. Speaking of moving gear along, right? Yeah, nice little segue there. We've had some key contributions lately from community members just in the last month, but also, you know, over the last period of time. And I just feel like I want to acknowledge those. You know, they have donated analog gear or older digital gear to the digital story. And not only does this prevent needless landfill waste, right? It's not going to go in the trash. It's not going to, end up somewhere where it's not being used. It puts creative tools in the hands of those who really appreciate the items. And that's what I love about this. So I wanted to just give a shout out to Kevin, to Mark, to Colin. You know, you guys have stepped up lately. You've contacted me through the Nimble Photographer contact form, and that's thenimblephotographer.com. Just click on contact, and it even has a little place there that you have some used gear that you want to donate. You can do that. They've done that. Then they followed through, and they actually got the stuff shipped to me. I'm already working on a bunch of it, and I'm going to have it in the hands of someone who can use it. Probably within the next few weeks, depending on who wants what when, right? Thank you so much. This is really cool, and I really appreciate you guys making that extra effort to help keep this podcast going and support our community. Here's kind of an interesting story, and I'll just lay it out for you. It was on Petapixel, and I have the link to the story in the show notes so you can read the whole story. I'm going to kind of read the major chunks of it so you get the idea of what's going on here. And then I'll comment a little bit about it afterwards. You know, right before I actually read the story, I want to tell you that I'm a huge Lady Gaga fan, right? So this is definitely not intended to put a knock on her, but I do think this is an interesting story, and here's what it is. Lady Gaga criticizes music pirates with pirated photos. Shutterstock responds. All right, let me just read you what Petapixel wrote here. And, you know, they were repurposing an article that's been published in a couple other places. After Lady Gaga's new song, Stupid Love, leaked onto the internet and went viral last weekend, the singer called out fans who had listened to the unauthorized release. Problem was, Lady Gaga's tweet used a pirated stock photo that had Shutterstock watermarks splashed across it. And this unauthorized usage didn't escape the company's notice. "We hear you," Shutterstock writes. "We like artists to be paid for their work too. Here's a link to the photographer's work where you can license these quality images." I guess there were two of them in there. It turns out the photographer behind the stock photos is children's author Richard Nelson. And he doesn't seem to mind not getting paid for the usage. In fact, he tweeted out a non-watermarked version of Lady Gaga's message for the singer to use. And here's what he said in the tweet. "At Lady Gaga, as the photographer of this picture, I've got you." And then he did some nice emojis after that. But from the conversations this incident has sparked online, it seems clear that the vast majority of photographers agree with Shutterstock. Copyright is important, but not just for musicians. It needs to be respected and defended for all artists, including photographers. So, first of all, there's a lot going on here. You know, there has been this ongoing tension, or at least these incidents, between recording artists and photographers. Photographers take their pictures, and then there's this whole kerfuffle around can the recording artist, you know, use the shot without permission because it's of them. All that stuff, right? So that is not news. This was a little different, though, because, you know, in this case, Lady Gaga or whoever tweeted for Lady Gaga, I totally agree with the message, which is, hey, you know, pirated music is a bummer. You know, just buy the song, please. And thinking about that, but not at the same time, really thinking about the image that you use for the tweet. I think Shutterstock wasn't out of line to kind of fire back at that, or to clap back, as we like to say in sports, to clap back at that. I think that was well within their right. I'm not a huge fan of Shutterstock, but I agree with their sentiment here. But what I really loved about this story was the photographer, right? The guy who was like in the middle of all of this, and it was his picture, and he's just saying, you know what? I've got you. He later on said that, hey, you know, what do I have to complain about? You know, my photographs are in a viral tweet from Lady Gaga. And it sort of reminded me of something that I learned when I was working with Tim O'Reilly at O'Reilly Media. And one of his pearls of wisdom was, and he was talking about, you know, theft of their IP, right? Because, you know, they're writing all these books and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And he used to say that, you know, really in his view, content theft wasn't the biggest problem when you're a content creator. He says anonymity is the big problem, right? So you know, even though they would take steps against content theft and everything, they would also just give away a bunch of books, give away a bunch of content, give all that sort of stuff away, because really, you know, none of that matters if no one knows who you are, right? No one's going to steal your stuff if they don't know who you are. And that, you know, that sometimes you don't want to be so protective of your stuff that only you know about it, right? Only you know. So it's a little bit of a Scrooge thing, right? Where you just, you know, I got all my money here, but I'm the only one that, you know, can enjoy it. I just think that the real star of this story is the photographer, who really seemed to have his eye on the big picture, who was good-natured about it, and just sort of diffused the whole situation. So anyway, it's an interesting anecdote. Like I said, you know, I'm not trying to knock anyone here, Lady Gaga or Shutterstock or anyone. I thought it was a good story, and really what I wanted to highlight is the hero of the story, the photographer himself. I have a few updates on our workshop season. First of all, I have dates now for our Eastern Sierra Photography Workshop. This is the one that's going to be based out of Bridgeport, California. This is the one that addresses, hopefully, fall color in that area, you know, around June Lake. This is the area also that has Mono Lake. This is just a fantastic place. I mean, I have done, four or five workshops there now, and I just love it. Every time we do a workshop there, it's just crazy fun. The dates are October 1 through 3. So we're going to do a Thursday, Friday, Saturday workshop. And then, you know, if you want, you know, you still have a Sunday as a travel day, or you can add on either before or after the workshop if you want to stay longer. But the dates are, for planning purposes, and this is for folks on the reserve list or folks thinking about getting on the reserve list, October 1 through 3, 2020. Those are the dates for our Eastern Sierra Photography Workshop, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday in October. I think we're going to have some good color then, just based on all the research that I've done. Cross your fingers. And even if we don't have peak color, we are going to have a peak good time, because it's such a fantastic place. Updates on the other workshops. We still have one seat open for the LA Photography Experience. That's March 13 through 15 coming up. That's the trip that I just got back scouting from. So we have one seat open there. Right now, at the moment, we don't have any seats open for the Humboldt Redwoods, May 12 through 14. However, if you have your heart set on that workshop, contact me and I can put you on a wait list. Things happen, right? Things happen. So, you know, you definitely want to be on the wait list if you really want to go to that workshop. And I have two seats remaining for the Lassen Volcanic Park Photo Workshop, July 16 through 18. That's going to be based out of Lake Almanor. That's where we have this terrific, fantastic, amazing cabin available to us. We're all going to stay there together. It's got many, many rooms. It's really a wonderful place. We have two seats open for that, and that is on July 16 through 18. So things are just looking really nicely for the workshop season. One seat open for LA Street Photography, none at the moment for Humboldt, two for Lassen, and Eastern Sierra Workshop, we have two seats open right now on the reserve list, and that's going to be October 1 through 3 for that last workshop of the season. If you want to get on one of these reserve lists, then all you have to do is go to thenimblephotographer.com, click on workshops, and you can put your deposit down right there. It's only $100, and that holds your spot. If you're interested in the Humboldt workshop, go to thenimblephotographer.com also, but use the contact form and let me know that you want to be on the wait list for Humboldt Redwoods. One last thing I want to say about workshops. Some of the workshops are during the week, like Humboldt Redwoods, and we do that on purpose because, you know, people who want to photograph redwoods usually don't want a ton of people around. We have fewer people during the week, but I have some folks saying, hey, it's hard for me to get off work and, you know, do all this, you know, to attend a workshop during the week. It'd be much easier if you did it on the weekend. I try to balance that. We have two that go into the weekend, both the LA and now the Eastern Sierra, and then we have two that we do during the week. Just something to think about when you're thinking about my workshops or anyone else's. All right, just a little virtual camera club business. First of all, huge, gigantic thanks to our Inner Circle members. They are the folks that keep this podcast on the air month in and month out, and their support is so valuable to our community. If you're interested in becoming an Inner Circle member, just click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. Go over there, look at our site. Look at our site, see what's going on, and hopefully maybe 2020 is the year that you become an Inner Circle member and join in the stuff that we have going on there. And again, big thanks to our folks who are there right now. You guys are the best. Also want to mention that I have a Photos for macOS Catalina and iPad OS training on both LinkedIn Learning and lynda.com. I'm getting really good feedback from that. I think it's one of the better trainings that I've done in recent history. And one of the notes that I'm getting from people is that they did not realize that Photos had evolved this much and that does this amount of stuff. If you're interested, if you have Photos already, if you own a Mac, you already have Photos. If you have an iPad, you already have Photos. If you have it already, you might want to take a look at this training just to see what's going on there. I have tiles on the digital story for both B&H and Amazon. If you're going to make a purchase from them, if you hear about something in the podcast and you say, I want to go buy that after you go through the five steps that we talked about today, right? After you do that, then if you click on those tiles first in the second column, then navigate to the item that you want, that helps support this show. And the way that it does that is those links, either through the tiles or in the show notes, those contain affiliate code that credits us for activity for your purchases that you may make when visiting a site after clicking here first. We may receive some financial compensation. Hopefully we do, from those purchases. That doesn't cost you anything more, but it does help support the site. And you should know that's the way that it works. And finally, a huge thanks to our friends at Red River Paper. They are the folks that supply, I think, the best variety of inkjet printing paper on the planet. Super high quality. They're very passionate about printing. They have a site that just covers everything, you know, from ink to paper to reviews, you know, to tutorials. You want to know how to make fine art cards? Go to Red River Paper, right? You want to know how to get to Red River Paper, click on the tile that's on all the pages of the digital story, and it will take you there. They also have a wonderful Facebook page at facebook.com/redriverpaper. Go there, get some paper, make some art, and then hand somebody something that you created from start to finish. Red River Paper can make that happen with you. Thank you so much for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed our little gear talk that we had together. I'm working on some more great stuff for next week. Come back and see me then. Until then, have a great week. Bye-bye now.